This is abundance. Dane Allred's Rules of Engagement, Roadrunner. Most of our barriers in life are mental. We create them, feed them, keep them growing and prospering in our heads. I've run 4 marathons, though those who were watching the race will tell you I was jogging and sometimes walking. But I didn't get to the end of my 4th marathon by standing up one day and saying, I will run a marathon tomorrow. I thought I could barely run a mile when I was in junior high. I'd been excused to go down to the high school track and train for the high school team, which meant, of course, I went and played on the high jump pit. It didn't prepare me to run, but it was fun while it lasted. Unfortunately, I was signed up to run the mile. I had never run a mile, but there's no way I'm going to admit this to the coach. So like an idiot, I line up with everyone else and completely embarrass myself. The guy who was supposed to finish behind me was smarter than me. He quit. So when I ran across the finish line and someone shouted, "Hey, the race is over," he was right. I collapsed on the side of the track and found out I was hyperventilating. It's interesting to float 3 feet off the ground. I never ran another step until 10 years later. I was 25 and some friends from California were in town. They were taking a week-long Fitness for Life class and invited me to run in a 5K race with them on Saturday. My mind put up the obstruction about the junior high race, but I was now mature enough to tell myself, I am not my past. I agreed to run with them, but needed to do some work in the 5 days before the race. I found out a 5K is 3.1 miles. I got in my car and measured how far I had to run from my house to equal 3.1 miles by the time I returned. I also measured where the first half mile was. That night, I ran a mile. I was surprised since I had told myself for 10 years I couldn't run a mile. I don't remember how long it took or how slowly I ran. I only remember I ran the whole mile. I decided this must be a fluke and rested for a day. Then I ran another mile, walked a mile, and ran another mile. Now I had run 2 miles in one day and walked another. I even felt like I could do more, but I didn't want to push it. I wanted to save something for Saturday. I showed up for the race, unsure if I could really run 3.1 miles without stopping. I decided to go very slowly and hope for the best. With 4 miles of training under my belt, I started my first race. It was a beautiful summer day with a crispness to the early morning air. I tried to focus on the road, ignore what my mind was telling me, that I was being an idiot, and simply plodded along. People passed me by, but I didn't care. I passed a couple of people. I made it the first mile, then the second mile. For the first time in my life, I had run 2 miles in a row. There was no stopping me now. I never stopped jogging. I even had a little energy left at the end of the race to sprint ahead of the 60-year-old lady in front of me and beat her. But I couldn't keep up with the 10-year-old that passed us both at the finish line. It didn't matter. I had done something I was positive I couldn't do, and it began a chapter in my life that I am still exploring. Every time I hear that nagging voice tell me, "You can't," I think back to that modest beginning race and how after about 10 years and many, many shorter races, I ran a marathon, and then another and another. I ran my slowest marathon ever just 2 months ago. We are all in our own private races, and most of the challenges we face are against ourselves, though we may tell ourselves we are competing against someone else. Think of it this way. When I ran my first marathon, I was in my 30s. Guess what the age bracket most of the winners of marathons are in? That's right. In the last Olympic marathon, a 38-year-old woman set a new world record. So I will never take first place in a marathon. Does that stop me? Only if I tell myself I can't. But the secret is, I know I can. that was a selection from Dane Allred's Rules of Engagement called Roadrunner. Today we're examining elusiveness number 386 from my list I call 1001 Thanks. Sometimes it's our own preconceived mental notions that are elusive. Sometimes it's just trying to make it from day to day. Making an abundance list helps me find my way. It's a list of 1001 things I'm thankful to find in this universe of abundance. You'll hear a lot of things on abundance. Some different things like musings about my week, usually a selection from famous writers or a poem or two. Some original poetry, maybe something to motivate you, but mostly to motivate me. Watch out. You may gain some elusive insight into yourself and everyone else. You never know what's next on Abundance. The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. $1.87. That was all. And 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and vegetable man and the butcher until one's cheeks burned with the silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealing implied. Three times Della counted it. $1.87. And the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it. Which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating. While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, take a look at the home. A furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beggar description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for the mendicancy squad. In the vestibule below was a letterbox into which no letter would go, and an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. Also appertaining thereunto was a card bearing the name Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during a former period of prosperity when its possessor was being paid $30 per week. Now the income was shrunk to $20, though, and they were thinking seriously of contracting it to a modest and unassuming D. But whenever Mr. James Dillingham Young came home and reached his flat above, he was called Jim and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della. Which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended to her cheeks with the powder rag. She stood by the window and looked out dully at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and she had only $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. She'd been saving every penny she could for months, with this result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses had been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim. Her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning for something nice for him, something fine and rare and sterling, something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim. There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. A very thin and agile person may, by observing his reflection in a rapid sequence of longitudinal strips, observe a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, but her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now there were two possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs in which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window some day to dry just to deprecate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon
been the janitor, with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed, just to see him pluck at his beard from envy. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. It reached below her knee and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again, nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood still while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet. On went her old brown jacket, on went her old brown hat, with a whirl of skirts and with the brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she fluttered out the door and down the stairs to the street. Where she stopped, the sign read, Madame Sofreny, hair, goods of all kinds. One flight up, Della ran, and collecting herself, panting, Madame, large, too white, chilly, hardly looked the Sofreny. Will you buy my hair? Said Della. I buy hair, said Madame. Take your hat off, and let's have sight at the looks of it. Down rippled the brown cascade. $20, said Madame, lifting the mask with a practiced hand. Give it to me quick, said Della. Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the hashed metaphor, she was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it, at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores. She had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone and not by meretricious ornamentation, as all good things should do. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value. The description applied to both. $21 they took from her, and she hurried home with the 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might properly be anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way a little prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas and went to work repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love, which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task. Within 40 minutes, her head was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at her reflection in the mirror long, carefully, and critically. If Jim doesn't kill me, she said to herself, before he takes a second look at me, he'll say I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made and the frying pan was on the back of the stove, hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard his step on the stair away down on the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit of saying little silent prayers about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think I'm still pretty." The door opened, and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked thin and very serious. Poor fellow, he was only 22, and to be burdened with a family, he needed a new overcoat, and he was without gloves. Jim stopped inside the door, as immovable as a setter at the scent of a quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments that she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly with that peculiar expression on his face. Della wriggled off the table and went for him. "Jim, darling," she cried, "don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold because I couldn't have lived through Christmas without giving you a present. It'll grow out again, and you won't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a beautiful, nice gift I've got for you."
You've cut off your hair," asked Jim laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet, even after the hardest mental labor.
"Cut it off and sold it," said Della. "Don't you like me just as well, anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I?"
Jim looked about the room curiously. "You say your hair is gone," he said, with an air almost of idiocy.
You needn't look for it," said Della. "It's sold, I tell you, sold and gone, too. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered," she went on with a sudden serious sweetness. "But nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put the chops on, Jim?" Out of his trance, Jim seemed quickly to wake. He enfolded his Della. For 10 seconds, let us regard with discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week or $1 million a year, what's the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it upon the table. "Don't make any mistake about Dell," he said. "About me, I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or shave or shampoo that could make me like my girl any less. But if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first." White fingers and nimble tore at the string and paper, and then an ecstatic scream of joy, and then, alas, a quick feminine change to hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the Lord of the Flat. For there lay the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoiseshell, with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear in the beautiful, vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession. And now they were hers, but the tresses that should have adorned the coveted adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom. At length, she was able to look up with dim eyes and a smile and say, "My hair grows so fast, Jim." And then Della leaped up like a little singed cat and cried, "Oh, oh, oh!" Jim had not seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her open palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with the reflection of her bright and ardent spirit. "Isn't it a dandy, Jim? I hunted all over town to find it. You'll have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. "Dell," he said, "let's put our Christmas presents away and keep 'em a while. They're too nice to use just at the present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs. And now suppose you put the chops on." The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of two foolish children in a flat who, most unwisely, sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these two were the wisest. Oh, and all who give and receive gifts, such as they are wisest. Everywhere, they are wisest. They are the Magi.
The Gift of the Magi by O. Henry. Available at danelawry.com anytime you'd like to listen to it. In just a moment, we'll continue with A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, Stave 3, the second of the three spirits. Awaking in the middle of a prodigiously tough snore and sitting up in bed to get his thoughts together, Scrooge had no occasion to be told that the bell was again upon the stroke of one. He established a sharp lookout all round the bed, for he wished to challenge the spirit on the moment of its appearance, and did not wish to be taken by surprise and made nervous. Now, being prepared for almost anything, he was not by any means prepared for nothing. He lay upon his bed, the very core and center of a blaze of ruddy light. He began to think that the source and secret of this ghostly light might be in the adjoining room, from whence, on further tracing it, it seemed to shine. This idea, taking full possession of his mind, he got up softly and shuffled in his slippers to the door. The moment Scrooge's hand was on the lock, a strange voice called him by his name and bade him enter. He obeyed. It was his own room, there was no doubt about that, but it had undergone a surprising transformation. In easy state upon this couch, there sat a giant, glorious to see, who bore a glowing torch, in shape not unlike Plenty's horn, and held it up, high up, to shed its light on Scrooge as he came peeping round the door. Come in, and know me better, man. I am the ghost of Christmas present. You have never seen the like of me before, exclaimed the spirit. Never, spirit. Conduct me where you will. I went forth last night on compulsion, and I learnt a lesson which is working now. Tonight, if you have aught to teach me, let me profit by it. Touch my robe! Scrooge did as he was told, and held it fast. All vanished instantly, the room, the fire, and all its contents, and they went on, invisible, straight to Scrooge's clerk. The spirit smiled, and stopped to bless Bob Cratchit's dwelling with the sprinkling of his torch. Then up rose Mrs. Cratchit, Cratchit's wife, and she laid the cloth, assisted by Belinda Cratchit, second of her daughters, while Master Peter Cratchit plunged the fork into the saucepan of potatoes, and now two smaller Cratchits, boy and girl, came tearing in, screaming that outside the baker's they had smelt the goose and known it for their own.
"Whatever's got your precious father, then?" said Mrs. Cratchit. "And your brother, Tiny Tim, and Martha weren't as late last Christmas day by half an hour."
"Here's Martha, mother," cried the two young Cratchits.
"Hurrah! Oh, there's such a goose, Martha."
"Why, bless your heart alive, my dear, how late you are."
"We'd a good deal of work to finish up last night, and had to clear away this morning, mother."
"Well, never mind, so long as you are come. Sit ye down before the fire, my dear, and have a warm, Lord bless ye."
"No, no, there's father coming," cried the two young Cratchits, who were everywhere at once.
"Hide, Martha, hide."
So Martha hid herself, and in came Bob the father and Tiny Tim upon his shoulder. Alas, for Tiny Tim, he bore a little crutch.
"Why, where's our Martha?" cried Bob Cratchit, looking around.
"Not coming."
"Not coming? Not coming upon Christmas Day?"
Martha didn't like to see him disappointed, if it were only in joke, so she came out prematurely from behind the closet door and ran into his arms, while the two young Cratchits hustled Tiny Tim and bore him off to the wash-house, that he might hear the pudding singing in the copper.
"And how did little Tim behave?"
"Oh, as good as gold, and better. Somehow he gets thoughtful sitting by himself so much, and
He thinks the strangest things you ever heard. He told me, coming home, that he hoped the people saw him in the church because he was a cripple, and it might be pleasant to them to remember upon Christmas Day who made lame beggars walk and blind men see. Bob's voice was tremulous when he told them this, and trembled more when he said that Tiny Tim was growing strong and hearty. At last, the dinner was all done. Then all the Cratchit family drew round the hearth. Then Bob proposed, "A Merry Christmas to us all, my dears. God bless us." Which all the family re-echoed.
"God bless us, everyone," said Tiny Tim, the last of all.
He sat very close to his father's side upon his little stool. Bob held his withered little hand in his as if he loved the child and wished to keep him by his side and dreaded that he might be taken from him.
"Spirit," said Scrooge, with an interest he had never felt before, "tell me if Tiny Tim will live." "I see a vacant seat," replied the ghost, "in the poor chimney corner, and a crutch without an owner, carefully preserved if these shadows remain unaltered by the future. The child will die."
"No, no, oh, kind spirit, say he will be spared."
"If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, none other will find him here. What then? If he be like to die, he had better do it and decrease the surplus population."
Scrooge hung his head to hear his own words quoted by the spirit and was overcome with penitence and grief.
"Man, will you decide what men shall live, what men shall die? It may be that in the sight of heaven you are more worthless and less fit to live than millions like this poor man's child."
Scrooge bent before the ghost's rebuke and trembling cast his eyes upon the ground, but he raised them speedily on hearing his own name.
"Mr. Scrooge," said Bob, "I give you Mr. Scrooge, the founder of the feast."
"The founder of the feast, indeed," cried Mrs. Cratchit, reddening. "I wish I had him here. I give him a piece of my mind to feast upon, and I hope he'd have good appetite for it."
"My dear, the children, Christmas Day."
"It should be Christmas Day, I am sure, on which one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy, odd, unfeeling man as Mr. Scrooge. You know who he is, Robert. Nobody knows it better than you do, poor fellow."
"My dear, Christmas Day."
"I'll drink his health for your sake and the day, not for his. Long life to him. A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. You'll be very merry and very happy, I have no doubt."
The children drank the toast after her. It was the first of their proceedings which had no heartiness. Tiny Tim drank it last of all, but he didn't care a tuppence for it. Scrooge was the ogre of the family. The mention of his name cast a dark shadow on the party, which was not dispelled for full 5 minutes. After it had passed away, they were 10 times merrier than before, and by they had a song about
a lost child traveling in the snow, traveling in the snow,
from Tiny Tim, who had a plaintive little voice, and sang it very well indeed. There was nothing of high mark in this. They were not a handsome family. They were not well dressed. Their shoes were far from being waterproof. Their clothes were scanty. But they were happy, grateful, pleased with one another, and contented with the time. And when they faded, and looked happier yet in the bright sprinklings of the spirit's torch at parting, Scrooge had his eye upon them, and especially upon Tiny Tim, until the last. Scrooge and the ghost were then in another place, a bright, dry, gleaming room. It was a great surprise to Scrooge to hear a hearty laugh. It was a much greater surprise to Scrooge to recognize it as his own nephew's. Laughed Scrooge's nephew. When Scrooge's nephew laughed in this way, holding his sides, rolling his head, and twisting his face into the most extravagant contortions, Scrooge's niece, by marriage, laughed as heartily as he. And their assembled friends, being not a bit behindhand,
roared out lustily.
He said that Christmas was a humbug, as I live. He believed it, too. More shame on him, Fred.
Oh, he's a comical old fellow, that's the truth, and not so pleasant as he might be. However, his offences carry their own punishment, and I have nothing to say against him.
Oh, I am sure he's very rich, Fred. At least you always tell me so.
What of that, my dear? His wealth is of no use to him. He don't do any good with it. He don't make himself comfortable with it. He hasn't the satisfaction of thinking that he is ever going to benefit us with it. I have no patience with him.
Oh, I have.
I am sorry for him. I couldn't be angry with him if I tried.
Who suffers by his ill whims?
Himself, always. Here, he takes it into his head to dislike us, and he won't come and dine with us.
What's the consequence? He don't lose much of a dinner.
Indeed, I think he loses a very good dinner. I was only going to say that the consequence of his taking a dislike to us and not making merry with us is, as I think, that he loses some pleasant moments, which could do him no harm. I mean to give him the same chance every year, whether he likes it or not, for I pity him. He may rail at Christmas till he dies, but he can't help thinking better of it. I defy him, if he finds me going there in good temper year after year, and saying, "Uncle Scrooge, how are you?" If it only puts him in the vein to leave his poor clerk £50, oh, and I think I shook him yesterday. It was now their turn to laugh at the notion of his shaking Scrooge.
"Here is a new game," said Scrooge. "One half-hour spirit, only one."
It was a game called Yes and No, where Scrooge's nephew had to think of something and the rest must find out what, he only answering to their questions yes or no. The brisk fire of questioning to which he was exposed elicited from him that he was thinking of an animal, a live animal, rather a disagreeable animal, a savage animal, an animal that growled and grunted sometimes, talked sometimes, lived in London, walked about the streets, wasn't made a show of, wasn't led by anybody, didn't live in a menagerie, was never killed in a market, and was not a horse or an ass or a cow or a bull or a tiger or a dog or a pig or a cat or a bear. At every new question that was put to him, this nephew burst into a fresh roar of laughter and was so inexpressibly tickled that he was obliged to get up off the sofa and stamp. At last, the plump sister cried out,
"I have found it out. I know what it is, Fred. I know what it is."
"What is it?"
"It's your Uncle Scrooge."
Which it certainly was. Admiration was the universal sentiment, though some objected to the reply to "Is it a bear?" ought to have been yes. He has given us plenty of merriment, I am sure, and it would be ungrateful not to drink his health. Here's a glass of mulled wine ready to our hand at the moment, and I say, Uncle Scrooge, a merry Christmas and a happy New Year to the old man, whatever he is. He wouldn't take it from me, but he may have it. Nevertheless, Uncle Scrooge. Uncle Scrooge had imperceptibly become so light of heart that he would have thanked them in an inaudible speech if the ghost had given him time, but the whole scene passed off in the breath of the last words spoken by his nephew, and he and the spirit were again upon their travels. It was a long night, if it were only a night, but Scrooge had his doubts of this, because the Christmas holidays appeared to be condensed into the space of time they passed together. It was strange, too, that while Scrooge remained unaltered in his outward form, the ghost grew older, clearly older.
"Forgive me if I am not justified in what I ask," said Scrooge, looking intently at the spirit's robe. "But I see something strange and not belonging to yourself protruding from your skirts. Is it a foot or a claw?"
"It might be a claw, for the flesh there is upon it. Look here!"
From the foldings of its robe, it brought two children, wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, miserable. They knelt down at its feet and clung upon the outside of its garment.
"Oh, man, look here, look! Look down here!" exclaimed the ghost.
They were a boy and a girl, yellow, meager, ragged, scowling, wolfish, but prostrate, too, in their humility. Scrooge started back, appalled. Having them shown to him in this way, he tried to say they were fine children, but the words choked themselves.
"Spirit, are they yours?"
Scrooge could say no more.
They are man's, and they cling to me, appealing from their fathers. This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both, and all of their degree, but most of all beware this boy, for on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased. Deny it! Have they no refuge or resource? Are there no prisons? Said the spirit, turning on him for the last time with his own words. Are there no workhouses?
The bell struck 12. Scrooge looked about him for the ghost and saw it not. As the last stroke ceased to vibrate, he remembered the prediction of old Jacob Marley, and lifting up his eyes, beheld a solemn phantom, draped and hooded, coming like a mist along the ground towards him. Next week, Stave 4 of Christmas Carol, here on Abundance. In just a moment, more sonnets by William Shakespeare. Out Loud, Sonnet 76 by William Shakespeare. Why is my verse so barren of new pride, so far from variation or quick change? Why with the time do I not glance aside to newfound methods and to compounds strange? Why write I still all one, ever the same, and keep invention in a noted weed that every word doth almost tell my name, showing their birth and where they did proceed? Oh no, sweet love, I always write of you, and you and love are still my argument. So all my best is dressing old words new, spending again what is already spent. For as the sun is daily new and old, so is my love still telling what is told. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 77 by William Shakespeare. Thy glass will show thee how thy beauties wear, thy dial how thy precious minutes waste, the vacant leaves thy mind's imprint will bear, and of this book, this learning, mayest thou taste. The wrinkles which thy glass will truly show of mouthed graves will give thee memory. Thou, by the dial's shady stealth, mayest know time's thievish progress to eternity. Look, what thy memory cannot contain, commit to these waste blanks, and thou shalt find those children nursed, delivered from thy brain, to take a new acquaintance of thy mind. These offices, so oft as thou wilt look, shall profit thee, and much enrich thy book. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 78 by William Shakespeare. So oft have I invoked thee for my muse, and found such fair assistance in my verse, as every alien pen hath got my use, and under thee their poesy disperse. Thine eyes that taught the dumb on high to sing, and heavy ignorance aloft to fly, have added feathers to the learned's wing, and given grace a double majesty. Yet be most proud of that which I compile, whose influence is thine, and born of thee. In others' works thou dost but mend the style, and arts with thy sweet graces graced be. But thou art all my art, and dost advance as high as learning my rude ignorance. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 79 by William Shakespeare. Whilst I alone did call upon thy aid, my verse alone had all thy gentle grace. But now my gracious numbers are decayed, and my sick muse doth give another place. I grant, sweet love, thy lovely argument deserves the travail of a worthier pen. Yet what of thee? Thy poet doth invent, he robs thee of and pays it thee again. He lends thee virtue, and he stole that word from thy behavior. Beauty doth he give, and found it in thy cheek. He can afford no praise to thee, but what in thee doth live. Then thank him not for that which he doth say, since what he owes thee, thou thyself dost pay. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 80 by William Shakespeare. Oh, how I faint when I of you do write, knowing a better spirit doth use your name, and in the praise thereof spends all his might, to make me tongue-tied, speaking of your fame. But since your worth, wide as the ocean is, the humble as the proudest sail doth bear, my saucy bark, inferior far to his, on your broad main doth willfully appear. Your shallowest help will hold me up afloat, whilst he upon your soundless deep doth ride, or being wrecked, I am a worthless boat, he of tall building and of goodly pride. Then if he thrive and I be cast away, the worst was this, my love was my decay.